ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, really fun show lined up this week. Joining me will be Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions, who they work with over 2,100 advisory firms. They help them with everything from back-end technology to the investment side of the equation. And we're actually going to cover a topic that straddles both of these. It's a favorite topic of mine, direct indexing, which some have called an ETF killer, right? There's this thought that direct indexing will take over the world and nobody will use ETFs and mutual funds in 10 years. Though I have to mention, mutual funds launched in the 1920s and they're still around. Yeah, but I guess different topic. In any event, Orion offers direct indexing as part of their tech stack to advisors. And Rusty does believe there are some potentially significant advantages here. And so we're going to get into quite a bit of detail on this topic. We'll explain what direct indexing is, in case you're new to this. We'll talk pros, cons, even the competitive landscape, like what happens when brokerages such as Schwab and Fidelity get involved here. So this should be a good conversation. I'll also be joined this week by one of my favorite guests and, quite frankly, one of my favorite people in the ETF space, Christian Magoon, founder and CEO of Amplify ETFs. And if you follow me on Twitter, you might have seen my tweet last week where I noted Amplify has really been an under-the-radar success story. They've had $2.7 billion in net inflows just over the past year, and they now have $4.5 billion in assets altogether. And I like to think I follow this stuff pretty closely. I honestly had no idea. I mean, I was surprised to see this when I was doing a little homework. So we'll talk about that, and then we'll also dig into two of their ETFs that cover areas I always love discussing, blockchain and cannabis. Now, to start this week, I have ETF.com's Drew Voros on the line with me from California. Just yesterday, ETF.com released the finalists for their annual ETF awards. I call these the ETF Grammys or ETF Oscars. These are the most coveted awards in the industry. And so we're going to take a look at some of the finalists right now.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Nate.
Okay, so we now have the finalists for ETF.com's annual ETF Awards. I personally look forward to these every year. I just think they're such a great way to celebrate the innovation and all the hard work occurring in ETFs. Now, this year, there are a total of 16 categories, five nominees, I believe, in every category. And I should note, these awards represent the calendar year 2020. These aren't the 2021 awards. I think sometimes people get that confused. But I guess first, as you look across the list of finalists overall, what stood out to you? Like any commonalities, anything in stark contrast to prior years?
So first of all, thanks, Nate, for bringing this up. I kind of compare it more to the Oscars. And the reason I do that is because I really look at the ETF issuer landscape as sort of the studios. The big studios are the big three, iShares, Vanguard, State Street. Then you have these mid-tier players, and then you have the independent filmmakers, if you will, the up-and-coming, the next Quentin Tarantino's, which you can say is ARC right now. So I kind of compare it that way. And in the awards, we have sort of the actors, and we have the products, and and other things. And what I really, what stood out to me is the real mix here. We have the big studios, or the big three certainly have their name there, but we have a lot of the mid-tier and a lot of the up-and-comers. And certainly you just mentioned Christian Magoon and iBuy, for instance, the online retailer, has been sitting there and just collecting money as people suddenly have this awakening this year that this is the fund to be in if you're thinking retail. Meanwhile, it's been there for years and years. And so it's really hit the scene and really resonated. So there's a lot of products out there that are hitting niche markets that are really resonating. And then there's some tried and true products with the old studios continue to make a lot of money on it and bring in a lot of investors because they work.
Well, let's go through some of the categories, and we're not going to cover all of these. The full list is available at ETF.com. But I want to start with the Lifetime Achievement Award. This was won last year by the godfather of ETFs, right, Reggie Brown. The finalists for 2020 are Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas, Innovator ETF's Bruce Bond, Bitwise's Matt Hogan, Burton Malkiel, who I have to say, he wrote one of my favorite books, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and then Jan Van Eck, of course, president and CEO of Van Eck, a top 10 ETF issuer. Obviously, some big names here have had a lot of impact on the space. Any initial thoughts?
Yeah, so I think the initial thought is they've impacted the space in different ways. And a lot of the folks like Bruce Bond, Matt, and even Bert are not really in the jobs that got them where they're here as lifetime achievement. They're still doing the same thing but different roles. You know, for instance, Bruce Bond helped start PowerShares, and then that was eventually sold to Invesco. Now he's reinvented himself again, an innovator with the buffer ETFs. They're a risk management tool that have come to the ETF space, and again, given another tool for investors to use in the ETF toolbox. And Eric has designed, Balchunas at Bloomberg has designed some of the most groundbreaking data for ETFs that are on the Bloomberg terminal. He's one of the thought leaders in the space all the way around. And of course, Bert is, as you mentioned, it comes from Yale, you know, longtime Yale professor, longtime director at Vanguard, 30 years, I believe. And of course, has written a book that is commonly referenced. So he is sort of the, you talked about Reggie being the godfather. I mean, Bert is up there with Bogle as sort of one of the gods of indexing and passive investing. So a very much a luminary. Jan Van Eck. Van Eck has been one of the first ETF issuers. Jan has been there from the beginning on the ETF side, and of course the Van Eck mutual funds have been around for decades. And so Van Eck has always had a spot in the industry and always capitalized where they went to. And of course, the whole idea of gold miner ETFs all come from Van Eck, and one of the most popular tools, along with a wide array of products. I think they have some $40 billion in AUM. Used to be a very big player in the commodity space and now branched out throughout the industry and a very well-known name. So I think it's a group that has a depth in impacting the ETF industry and for most of them have changed and continue to change but continue to impact. For instance, Matt now with Bitwise has brought indexing into the crypto space with the first publicly traded on an exchange crypto fund that has the top 10 crypto coins in an index, has $1 billion in it. So bringing sort of the indexing mentality, the passive mentality, it's always sort of been the DNA in the ETF industry, and I think it's sort of exemplified with these lifetime achievement nominees.
Very well said. It's a great list, and I should note, I am on the award selection committee, so as we go through these, I do want to stay impartial. I'll just add that everyone here is clearly very deserving. I've been fortunate to meet and interact with everyone on this list except Burton Malkiel. Hopefully that'll change someday. But there's no question everyone here has made meaningful contributions to the ETF space and really helped it become what it is today. Drew, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to, you did mention that you are part of the voting committee. Let me just point out real quickly how the methodology works, that this is really comes from the public. So the nominations, we put out a story back in January. We asked for nominations from the public in all the categories that we list. So we get that we had something double of what we had last year in terms of ballots, in the hundreds, almost 400 individual ballots with all the nominations on there. So we collect all of those. and we make sure all the categories are correct, and we correlate them, and then we whittle them down. And we certainly guard against ballot stuffing because we can see where ballots come from. All the ballots have an email, and people can only vote once, and it is a registered type of thing. And then, of course, we eventually take the finalists, and we put them out to voting to a committee, which you're on, which has, 12 people. It's our jury, if you will, of persons like yourself, including, even though Eric Balstrunas is on it, of course, he won't be voting on the Lifetime Achievement Awards, but it's filled with advisors. People are using ETFs. We do have a couple people from FactSet, like Elizabeth Kashner, but we've really taken the issuers out of the voting, and we've taken really the people that are using these products and using the companies and know these people the best who are really voting on it, like yourself.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I still see some trolls out in places like Twitter. I saw them yesterday sort of pushing this narrative that ETF issuers are paying for these awards or there's something nefarious going on behind the scenes and ETF.com is somehow taking ad dollars from issues directly relating to these awards. I've been involved in the process. None of that is happening.
No, it's not, and it goes to the integrity. I mean, we're an independent editorial voice. We don't take money to put stories on the site. So, taking money to give an award would be meaningless, and I don't think I'd want to win an award that I paid for, and I don't think most issuers would either.
Okay, let's go through a few of the other categories here. Another big one, this is like Best Picture or Album of the Year, ETF of the Year. So the five finalists are one you mentioned, the Amplify Online Retail ETF, ticker iBuy, the ARK Innovation ETF, ARKK, no surprise there, the Direction Work From Home ETF, ticker WFH, the Invesco QQQ Trust, QQQ, I think that may surprise some people, and then the Invesco Solar ETF, TAN, so two ETFs from Invesco. Any color commentary you'd offer on these?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is kind of old school, new school, and then real new school. So you have one of the oldest, most used ETFs in the Invesco QQ Trust, QQQ, which is basically the top NASDAQ companies. That's been around forever, sort of the tech fund of old. And that did very well last year. Kind of caught people surprised when you mentioned it, but it was up over 40, almost 50% last year. So this is sort of the classic index fund that didn't do anything special but maintained what it did, and it had a very good year. Did it produce the pop that some of the other funds like ARK did, which is innovative technology? No, but it also maintained its thesis of taking the top tech companies on NASDAQ, which, of course, are the fuel to raise the tide for the innovative ETFs. And then Invesco Solar ETF, TAN, is sort of the same thing. It's the only game in town when it comes to solar ETFs, which is kind of amazing. And it's used in various ways. Again, it's been around a long time. It's also used as a trading tool when it comes to shorting the solar industry. So it, again, did very well last year. In fact, was one of, if not the, I think it was the top ETF performer last year, up some 200%. So obviously, there is performance behind these on all of them, sort of like the MVP in the Super Bowl usually goes to the winner, not the loser. And the most valuable ETF of the year has been in these same classifications. We all know about ARK Innovation ETF, ARKK, took in a boatload of money, went up in three digits, over 100% last year. Has been a real story, and again, a reference back to the sort of the independent filmmaker that's crashing the party at the studios. Certainly, Kathy Wood is doing that at ARK, and she's seen some choppy seas here, as everybody has over the last few weeks, but the investors are sticking with her, and that's what's important, I think. Because it's an active manager, you're not going to bail on the active manager when it's bad. Hope that's where the active manager is mitigating losses, and we'll see what happens here. And of course, you mentioned Amplify Online Retail, iBuy. Again, it's been a product that's been here, made a lot of sense when it came out. Didn't have this huge demand at first, but it's really gaining momentum. As we all, especially during the pandemic, have just become used to online buying. Just the idea of brick and mortar is almost so far in the rearview mirror now, it's almost a mistake when you find yourself in a store for a lot of us. And then finally, Direction Work From Home ETF, WFH, is the new kind of indie on the block. So what's happened here, obviously, we had the pandemic a year ago, and very quickly Direction came out with a product that people could understand right away, that, you know, we're all now working from home, so let me look around and see what I'm doing while I work from home. What are the products that I'm using? So it makes a lot of sense to people. With that said, I think that's had more headlines than assets. The assets haven't been as strong as, you know, you would expect for something with the headlines it has. It has $100 billion in AUM, which is pretty good for any fund that's less than a year old. But again, we'll see how the demand goes. And it's performing well, too. Again, it's very tech-heavy, so it's more of a tech fund, certainly, than traditional passive funds that might focus on office space or some other things that come with work, travel, for instance. So it's sort of a new way of looking at the way we all work and make money.
That work from home ETF was interesting to me, just because, to your point, I do think this was sort of the poster child for all of the pandemic-inspired ETF launches last year. And I'll be completely honest, when I first saw this back when it launched, it felt a bit gimmicky to me. But you look, I mean, this thing does now have well over $100 million in assets. And its success is reflected in the ETF.com awards. So WFH is a finalist for Best New ETF, Best New U.S. Equity ETF, Best Ticker, and Direction as a whole is up for Issuer of the Year. Pretty impressive.
I think it's the ability to react and come up with products that again, people can see and resonate and use. And again, let me not downplay that, you know, $130 million in AUM is significant for any new ETF. But again, this is one of those, as you said, everybody knows what work from home is. They're there in a place. And again, I kind of see this as sort of like iBuy, that it makes a lot of sense right now. Maybe people aren't doing it right now, but, maybe in a couple of years, it's just sort of a second nature to say, well, yeah, I don't really want to invest in REITs and office space because I think people are working from, so it's sort of that shift in mentality that has to happen, just like the shift from mentality from brick and mortar to online, and thus we're seeing, you know, iBuy not only perform, but again, sort of almost the automatic reference when it comes to retail, and not necessarily just online retail. I think everybody realizes that's where the space is right now, and again, being the first person in that space with a ticker that works is going to work for a long time.
All right, Drew, just a couple minutes left. Let's go rapid fire here, like 30 seconds on each of these. So first, I want to mention another ETF that's a finalist in several categories. That's the iShares U.S. Small Cap Value Factor ETF, ticker symbol SVAL. This is up for Best New ETF, Best New U.S. Equity ETF, and Best New Smart Beta ETF. And to me, when this thing launched back last October, I remember this overall feeling that the timing wasn't great, right? That iShares was launching this after small cap value had underperformed for a long time. But looking back now, this might have been perfect timing, because you look at performance, this ETF is up like 65% since launching.
Hey, it's better to be luck than skillful sometimes, right? And we saw this back with HACK, the cybersecurity ETF that came out right when the South Koreans were North Koreans, I apologize, were supposedly hacking Sony, and the whole corporate idea that you could be exposed at any moment. So that was a perfect timing, and this was perfect timing because the debate had been out there. Value had been the punching bag going into this. And then suddenly, not only did we see value turn, but we saw small caps turn. And small caps are benefiting, obviously, from what's going to happen now with the stimulus, because the money's here in the U.S. So small cap companies benefit much more from sales in the U.S., whereas we're still seeing a lot of restrictions in global trade, whether it be, you know, airlines, just basic tourism, etc. You know, the small caps here in the U.S. are going to benefit quickly. And we're seeing the performance there. And so you had this combination of two things that kind of got lost in the shuffle of all of 2020's superb performance, because small caps didn't perform very well, because value is a punching bag. Suddenly, you know, what wasn't in favor in the markets is hugely in favor. And again, it has $100 million, but keep in mind, it's launched in Halloween, so really only had a couple months of the year when people were thinking about this going into the nomination. So I think it immediately, again, put a new tool in the ETF toolkit that wasn't there before, a value fund focusing on small cap, coming from iShares. I mean, it has all the right elements.
All right, that was 2.5 minutes instead of the 30. real quick here, because I want to get to these other categories. We have like a minute left. Okay, BETS, the Roundhill Sports Betting and iGaming ETF. This is also a finalist in multiple categories, right? Best new ETF, yep. Best thematic ETF, best new ticker. And I'll just say, look, we covered this pretty extensively last year. To me, this ETF made a ton of sense. I'm just not surprised by its success at all. And you look at the performance it's had, it's up over 100% since launching in June, which has certainly helped. Any quick thoughts on that one?
Yeah, first of all, it has $500 million in it, nearly. And, you know, it's still 9 months old or so. But again, timing is everything. So not only did it come out at a time, and I'm sure they projected this a little bit, that there was going to be legalization of sports gambling in states, particularly through the major companies like Caesars and Wynn. So what we're seeing is, you know, that timing worked, and then the pandemic along with it. We saw this, that people are now at home, they're betting at home, they're using apps, the states are legalizing sports betting. Perfect timing, resonated with the public, and a great ticker. You know exactly what you're getting to. You're making a bet on the betting companies.
Okay, last category I'll mention. This is probably the most coveted of the awards, ETF Issuer of the Year. And the finalists are ARK Invest, again, no surprise, Direction, who we talked about earlier with WFH, GlobalX, who had an excellent year with thematic ETFs, Innovator, with their success on the defined outcome ETFs, and then Vanguard. The question here I'll ask is this just an ARK landslide, or do you think these other issuers have a shot?
Well, I'll tell you what's always telling is, you know, here's Vanguard. I don't think we mentioned Vanguard yet. But yet, when it comes to Issuer of the Year, what do people immediately think? Well, my funds are in Vanguard, not mine personally, but my funds are. Vanguard is so used that it's right up there all the time on people's mind. And of course, ARK is there because of, you know, not only just RKK, but there are other funds, and going from $6-8 billion to almost 50 billion in a year is incredible. In Direction, along with GlobalX, has been coming out with products in the thematic area, hitting niches that people are using and finding value in. And Innovator ETFs, as I mentioned with Bruce Bond, has, again, produced a tool that wasn't in the ETF toolkit before, which is defined outcome ETFs, which cap your upside but also cap your downsize using flex share options. Sounds a little technical, but it's basically you're going to give up a little of the upside to protect you on the downside. And when we're in this kind of market of record after record, all-time highs, people are thinking about that parachute, and this has, again, provided it. So I think it's, again, a wide range, but you have, again, the big studio Vanguard is kind of staring down at its, you know, the people nibbling at its ankles and coming at them. So it's very interesting group, and despite the fact it's kind of old school, new school, the new school is very different when you start peeling those issuers apart.
Drew, before I let you go, the award ceremony itself, this will be a virtual event, April 20th, correct?
That's right, April 20th from 5 to 7 East Coast time. It's a Tuesday. You can sign up on the ETFFinalist.com story that's on ETF.com. It's free to the public. We're going to have Reggie Brown will be speaking. He did not get to speak last year, so he'll be talking about market making and his role in the ETF space. We're also going to have Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss speaking, keynote speaking on Bitcoin. We'll also have our new Lifetime Achievement Award winner will be speaking. That will be the only award that will be known beforehand, which that winner will know, so we can have them pre-recorded for the virtual event. It's going to be a show. It's going to be live from Hollywood, myself and Nick Harcourt, who's a musical and Los Angeles music celebrity of sorts. So we're going to make it a show as well. So we're looking forward for everyone to show up.
No question. I'll certainly be attending. I'm really excited to see who all the winners are. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Thank you, Nate. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. My next guest is Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions, who they provide back-end technology and investment solutions to over 2,100 advisory firms. And Rusty is now on the line with me from Omaha, Nebraska. Rusty, a pleasure connecting.
Good morning, Nate. Nice to be here.
Okay, so I know there are a number of areas you're extremely well-versed in as it relates to the markets and investing. However, we're going to focus on direct indexing this week, which is a topic I personally find fascinating. I know it's an area the ETF industry is watching closely. And as it turns out, Orion does offer a direct indexing solution. So as I usually like to do, let's start with a few basics. Do you want to just describe at a high level what direct indexing is?
Great, I sure will. So you're right. Direct indexing is definitely a hot topic, and for a lot of good reasons. I'm sure we're going to talk about a lot of those reasons today. So direct indexing, basically, the way I describe it, instead of owning an ETF on the S&P or a mutual fund in the S&P 500, you would own the underlying stocks of the S&P 500. Now, you could do something called a full replication where you own all 500, or you could own a smaller subset of it, managed in such a way that it's still going to basically replicate the return and the risk of the S&P 500. Other people may call direct indexing, by the way, a custom indexing or a personalized indexing, and I'm sure we'll kind of dive into those reasons as well later. But that's the basic way I describe it.
And we should mention, direct indexing isn't new, right? This is basically separately managed accounts. It's just that with the advances in technology, and now we have commission-free trading, fractional shares, all of that has sort of conspired to make this much more economically viable to the mainstream investor and advisor. Is that fair?
That is exactly it. I mean, but doesn't it sound cool to make it like a brand new thing and start the next thing, give it a fancy new name? So that's where all the excitement comes in, but you're absolutely right. This has been around for a long time, but it's now here in a much bigger size for some very good reasons that weren't around before. First of all, the technology has caught up. I mean, technology is able to just do all this stuff so much faster than before. I mean, that is different than it was decades ago. Brokerage commissions going to zero. That is huge for, again, bringing down the direct indexing to much smaller account minimums. I mean, it used to be you'd be able to do this sort of stuff. It took millions of dollars. I mean, we have minimums of $50,000. Another big thing is fractional shares. I mean, trading individual securities and fractional shares is also a very big deal because you're able to manage portfolios much tighter to their benchmarks, again, with the advent of fractional shares. I think another really big reason, though, which probably is not talked about enough, is that when it comes to advisors working with portfolios, with investors, they need to show their value. And we know there's so many different ways advisors add values to investors. You know, one of the easiest ways to quantify it in the past was through just beating the benchmark or showing your value versus the benchmark. Well, it's been really tough for active management in recent years. So how can an advisor quantify value to an investor? And one way you can do it is through direct index portfolios, particularly for taxable investors, because there's something called tax alpha. I'm sure we're going to dive into that, but that is a quantifiable measure that can actually show the value that an advisor brings to the table. It's just cut and dried, and it's a very real economic value.
In terms of the commission-free trading and then the fractional shares, I'll just add, when you think about what has changed over the past couple of years, think about if you wanted to direct index the S&P 500 a few years ago. And if you assume $5 trading commissions for each holding, you're talking about $2,500 just to set up your direct indexing portfolio. And that obviously doesn't include getting out of it or any changes you make. And then with the fractional shares, I think a perfect example is to think about a company like Amazon, which is currently trading at, $3,000 plus a share, 4% weighting in the S&P 500, you could see how pretty quickly that would become untenable holding that in a smaller dollar portfolio. So I think those are just two good examples of how things have changed besides the technology and certainly the advisor showing value aspect, which we can talk a little bit more about. Rusty, let's talk a little bit more about some of the potential specific benefits here, and then we'll get to the firing squad portion of our conversation.
Firing squad.
Well, explain the tax loss harvesting component in more detail. How does this help? Talk more about the quote-unquote tax alpha here.
Okay, so there are a lot of benefits to direct index accounts, and I personally feel that there's five of them that really stand out, but probably the tax management is the most important because when we come back to index funds, you know, if you buy the S&P ETF, for instance, SPY, that is tax efficient in its own. But I think a direct indexed solution on the S&P 500 is actually even more tax efficient over time. And let me kind of break it out. The reason why it is more tax efficient, instead of just having one tax slot, you will have, again, it depends on the portfolio, it depends on the application. But let's just say you're using the S&P 500, and let's say you're replicating that return with only 200 securities. So instead of having just one ticker, you have 200 different securities now in your portfolio. These 200 are not moving exactly the same. Some are going up, some are going down. Obviously, a lot of them tend to be correlated, but you're going to have stuff kind of zigging and zagging all over the place. When you have a security at a loss, you can realize that loss. And basically what you're doing is you're harvesting a tax credit to offset future gains. If you're aggressive doing this all year long, not just in December, just on the fourth quarter, but all year long, you can realize a lot of economic value from doing tax loss harvesting throughout the year. Now, there is sort of a rule of thumb on tax alpha. And let me just say tax alpha, the kind of the fancy definition for that is the difference between the excess after-tax return and the excess pre-tax return relative to a benchmark. And basically, what a tax alpha is trying to capture is there's a lot of different studies out there talking about, you know, I can think of maybe like five different studies out there. They range anywhere from tax alpha, you get 75 basis points to 200 basis points or 2% per year in tax alpha. Now, again, it depends on the strategy, and I'd like to dive into that a little bit later. But that tax alpha is, again, the very real benefit you get from doing this tax loss harvesting through the course of the year. One other point I want to make about those, like, 200 securities, not only are they zigging and zagging, but if you get a portfolio where, you know, the correlations between these individual securities are low, that's just that much more opportunity to realize tax alpha over time. So that's really the reason. You need lots of different securities. You need them to move a little bit differently. You just need to be aggressive harvesting tax credits over the course of the year, and you will be able to realize this tax alpha to benefit the investors' after-tax returns.
One thing I want to mention here, I'll state the obvious. Clearly, this is only relevant for investors with taxable accounts, right? Which is, you know, the vast majority of investable assets are held in retirement accounts. I do want to point that out. But certainly, if you have large balances in taxable accounts, this can clearly be meaningful. Rusty, one question I have on this. At some point, theoretically, can't you run out of tax loss harvesting opportunities, right? Let's just say the market kept going higher, because you don't want to be in a situation where you have an unending, you know, bucket of losers in your portfolio, right? So how does that play out? I mean, we've been in a market environment where everything's gone up for the most part.
You know, assuming there's no cash flows going in or out and the portfolio is held for a considerable amount of time, it does sort of get locked up. You're still getting a management aspect to it. I mean, things change. I mean, indexes can change, individual investor circumstances can change, but yes, it can get locked up. Then at that point, is it worth the fee? And again, the fees for direct index accounts are pretty darn low.
What does that look like for Orion?
Yeah, so, it depends where the industry is at. I think the industry is anywhere from up to 40 basis points. We tend to be about 25 basis points, so 0.25%. Is how much we charge for our direct index solution.
One thing I'm curious about is we talk about the cost that you charge. I'm curious about the back end cost. And how does this work with the indexes? So, for instance, is there a licensing fee if Orion wants to start with something like the S&P 500 and then allow a customization from there? How does that work with the index providers?
Yep. In the industry, if you are using an index from MSCI or from S&P or Russell, you will have to pay for it. One thing that we've seen in the direct index industry so far is a lot of people are kind of building their own indexes in-house. And if they're doing so, obviously they're going to have a good system in place, because ultimately, if you're trying to capture a market exposure, you have to do it in such a way that the investor, the users of those portfolios are comfortable and confident, and there are going to be no surprises in the type of returns and risk you're going to generate from your kind of self-created indexes. So anyway, there's a lot of firms kind of building their own indexes in-house now.
I'm really interested to see how the intellectual property plays out here longer term. Like, can you take the S&P 500, remove five stocks, call it, you know, something 495, and not have to pay the licensing fee to S&P Global? I'm not sure you know the answer to that, but I'm really fascinated to see how IP works in this space as it becomes more popular. Rusty, one of my biggest concerns with direct indexing, I've talked about this plenty on the podcast, is that I would contend it's basically active management, because you're taking an index and you're tweaking it. You're making an active decision to do something different, even if it's for the purposes of tax loss harvesting. Do you agree that direct indexing is active?
Now, this is a really juicy topic, and the whole debate about active versus passive, I mean, there's a lot of gray area in this. And to me, the truest definition is a passive management approach is you are trying to manage to a benchmark, and active is you're going to be different than the benchmark. And first of all, you could almost argue everybody is active because you could look at the global financial markets, and everybody has a tilt relative to that. Even if you want to break it down to the domestic financial markets, everybody has a tilt relative to that. But getting to your point, I think that if you're in a direct index account, it's all in the setup. And when an individual investor, when he or she is determining whatever they're trying to capture in their portfolio, whether it is a social responsible investing consideration, whether it's a concentration risk, whether if there's something particular that they have to customize that account for, which, by the way, is one of the values, I think, of the direct indexing as well. If they're doing that setup and they are staying disciplined to it, I don't really think that's active management over time. Now, indexes do change over time and individual circumstances change over time, and those are valid reasons for changes in the portfolio. What I don't think would be a valid consideration, which I would think would be suboptimal, is if an investor just for some emotional reason or whatever reason just said, you know, I don't like this security anymore. I think that obviously now getting is a little bit over the line into active management. And I think that's just the situation that an individual advisor has to work with an individual investor.
No, I think that's well said. And I guess I'll float a couple of examples at you. And just backing up, I want to make the point, I agree that every investment decision is active. And when we talk about direct indexing basically being active management, that's not a statement on whether active is good or bad. The concern that I have is I wonder if investors might be fully aware that there is the potential for tracking error. That would be my concern. And going through some examples, like we were talking tax loss harvesting earlier. And to me, there's no guarantee that whatever you replace a position with is going to perform the same. So I always use the example of Coke versus Pepsi, right? Let's say you were selling Coke at a loss and you want to get into Pepsi. There's no guarantee that Pepsi is going to perform the same way as Coke. And so that can introduce tracking error. That would be one example. Another example that I always like to use would be somebody like Facebook. So let's say a client wants to exclude Facebook because of Facebook's data privacy issues. And, you know, that goes against their values or whatever. And then Facebook, look, they put in a bunch of work. They end up becoming the hallmark of data privacy worldwide. The question I have is, like, what's the decision making to add Facebook back into the portfolio? That seems really tricky to me. Or even if just a client has a bad experience at some business, they go to Walmart or whatever, and they just don't want to own them. It just seems like a really slippery slope to me.
I think those latter two points are very good examples that it is a slippery slope. I don't even think that's a slippery slope. I think you've already slid off in those two situations. Now, the first one between Coke versus Pepsi, now, again, this is kind of getting to the weeds a little bit, but I think it's one of the most important discussions, not just about passive management, but also about active management, and that is the whole concept of tracking error. Again, we're talking about tracking error, talking about how return stream differs from a benchmark. If you look at tracking error, that really goes to the quality of passive management, and if you're just looking at active management, that goes to the character of active management. And then it depends on what level of tracking error you think is good passive management or good active management. And that is stuff that debates around. And even though it sounds kind of wonkish, I really do think it's one of the most important numbers that anybody could look at in terms of assessing a money manager or an investment strategy. I also think when it comes to direct index portfolios, particularly for taxable accounts, one of the key criteria is sort of that if you had to toggle between how important tracking error is versus tax alpha. Mm-hmm. And I have seen this debate play out many times, and I've seen it heated at times too. Pure risk managers, people who are very quantitative and very risk focused, they want those tracking errors as tight as possible. Now, I've seen a lot of advisors and investors, however, say, you know what, I can tolerate a little more tracking error. I really just don't want to pay as much in taxes. And that is completely fair. It's their money, and after-tax returns are important. So that is a really important thing to toggle, how much tracking error you can tolerate. A number that we use is kind of a threshold is 2%. And obviously, if you're an index fund, you have a tracking error of 2%, you're not a very good index fund. That is pretty sloppy. But I think for a direct index account where there is customization and there are tax considerations, 2% is a pretty good number.
One other tangible benefit I do want to point out that we haven't really dug into yet is that, let's say you work for a company like Apple and you own a bunch of Apple stock or stock options. Well, maybe you don't want to own Apple in an S&P 500 index fund, right? And so direct indexing can allow you to remove that. And I do think that can be a real benefit for people who have significant exposure to certain companies. I think we should point that out. Rusty, one area that I'm always curious about is reporting. So let's take Orion. Does a client get a report with all 500 stocks or whatever if they're direct indexing the S&P 500, or is it consolidated? Because that is, again, a real concern I've heard with direct indexing.
Well, I think this is a fair point. And, you know, one of, I would say, a potential downside to direct indexing, personally myself, because I do like simpler portfolios, is you will get performance reports and transaction reports that are going to have a lot of line items on them. You're going to have a lot of positions. Again, it depends on the strategy. I mean, there could be some direct index solutions that may have 30 or 50 names, but let's just go back to the example of the S&P 500, and let's say you're using the whole set of securities. So you got 500 names on there, and let's say you have a very volatile market environment where there's a lot of trading going on, that's going to be a pretty long report. And that is, you know, again, I actually think some advisors, in my own experience working with me over the years, some find that actually attractive. I personally don't. I like the simpler portfolio and the simpler statements myself.
Do you think technology at some point solves that, or there's perhaps some regulatory change to where all of those trades or positions can be consolidated? Or do you think it'll always be the case that they have to be sent to clients and listed, you know, itemized line item by line item?
Well, I'm going into the guessing territory here, but this would be my guess, is that, no, you're going to have to show all of that, mm-hmm. but there would be maybe an additional report that sort of simplifies it and summarizes it in a format which is much more user-friendly. I mean, the user experience is getting a lot better in so many different ways because of technology, and I think that is something that they will solve. I just want to take a step back, if I could, just really fast,
please,
some of the other benefits, yeah, of direct indexing, and we kind of touched upon them as well. I mean, again, a lot of people are really playing the card hard that this is really about personalization and customization. And sometimes I think that card is a little bit overplayed, though there are some real benefits to direct indexing. And we've already talked about one. And there are risk considerations that sometimes are very important. If you, let's just say your whole income and most of your portfolio is in technology, for instance, and obviously if you want a direct index solution, you're going to account for that and you're going to customize for that. There are some people who, They've owned General Electric stock for decades because their grandparents had it or something. You know, they might want to accommodate something for that. So there's that customization aspect as well. A really important one, too, is socially responsible, or ESG investing. And ESG investing is, you know, in many ways, there's still so much more talk about it than the actual asset flows. But I do think that direct indexing could be a game changer for ESG investing because you have that ability to get much more granular and actually hit the specific buttons that an investor wants. Right now, there's a lot of ESG products that are solid and good, but for somebody who really, really feels passionate about a particular topic, they might actually not like that broad-based thing. It just doesn't get to what they really want. With direct indexing, and particularly given all of the ESG indexes out there and how they're getting much more granular, they're going to be able to scratch that itch. And I think that's a really big deal. Another benefit, two other benefits, I think, of direct indexing, which probably don't get, they're not as sexy, so they probably get talked about as much. But one is, and I think this is probably is more attractive to an advisor, but it could be for investors as well, is just the whole concept of transition management. You have a big existing portfolio. You want to transition it to kind of a direct index solution, which is much more tax managed over time. That transition management, you put into a direct index solution, the technology and the fact that it's just looking at it every day and it's working with very clear constraints, I personally find that very attractive. And then kind of related to that is, again, a lot of these direct index solutions, because it's taking advantage of the technology, you're also basically automating a lot of the process. And kind of the old school way of tax managing a portfolio is you put something on your calendar and you did tax loss trading in December or the fourth quarter. Again, with this, it's just automated. It's just happening all the time. Last year is a great example. I mean, it's going to be really interesting the next few months how this concept of direct index is going to come through, because on one hand, you are going to have accountants. You're going to have a lot of paperwork to decipher, and let's see what kind of pushback they have. But on the other hand, you know, the tax alpha opportunities last year, it wasn't that 1 or 2% generically. I mean, if you were tax loss harvesting from the beginning of the year, given the fact that we had a 100-year flood in volatility early in the year, at Orion, we had some tax alpha numbers for some accounts that were 5-6% plus. I mean, it was just an extraordinary year. But if you were an advisor last year who waited to December to do any tax loss harvesting, you just didn't get it done. So the power of automation, I think, is also really important. Thank you for letting me just go back.
No, that was fantastic. One point that I'll tack on there, because I want to get your take on the impact of the ETF space overall. You know, you have some people out there that call direct indexing an ETF killer. To me, that's way overdone, which, again, we can get into. But I do think this could be an ESG ETF killer, just because, to your point, yeah. ESG ETFs, there's no one size fits all. And to me, ESG is extremely personal, which direct indexing can allow an investor to create exactly what they want. So that seems like a perfect application to me. Rusty, just a couple minutes left. What are your thoughts on how direct indexing could impact ETFs overall and sort of their market share?
Well, first of all, that was a great point about ESG ETFs, because that was extremely well said. I think that, as I would like to say about direct indexing, it's very underrated, very overrated. If you've never heard of it, it's underrated. But if you're thinking it's going to kill ETFs, it is overrated. ETFs are still going to have a purpose. I think if it's going to be more disruptive than anything, it's going to be more disruptive to sort of generic, conventional, old school, high net worth management of accounts with the high minimums, kind of doing it the old school way. I mean, this is doing a better job of running taxable money, lower costs, lower minimums. I think it's really going to be more disruptive to that space more than ETFs. ETFs are simple, easy to use. They're still tax efficient on a standalone basis. They're not going to go anywhere.
And then as you look at the direct indexing landscape overall, look, there are a number of established providers out there. Parametric, Aperio, certainly Orion all come to mind. There are several upstarts. Like, I think of somebody such as O'Shaughnessy's Canvas platform. But in my opinion, this functionality is going to be table stakes at all the major brokerages within the next, I don't know, 2-3 years. You know, Schwab, Fidelity, I feel like everyone will offer this. Do you agree with that? And if so, I mean, how do you see the competitive landscape evolving here?
I totally agree. And if I just wanted to create some controversy, I would take the under on your 2-3 years. Maybe 1-2 years. I don't know. Maybe even less. I agree. I mean, it is just so compelling. The technology is there. All the reasons are in place. Again, it is genuinely helping taxable investors. Probably some of the other stuff is overrated to some extent, but it's really helping investors. It's helping advisors help investors. It's going to stick around. It's going to become important. And the big companies are realizing that too. And they're building out capabilities. So I totally agree with you.
Well, Rusty, really enjoyed the conversation this week. We'll definitely have to have you back on just to talk markets. I'd love to get into investing and talk about your thoughts on that. But really appreciate you covering this topic of direct indexing. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate. Talk to you later.
That was Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions. I'm now joined by Christian Magoon, founder and CEO of Amplify ETFs, who currently offers 11 ETFs with about $4.5 billion invested. Christian is on the line with me from Colorado. Christian, always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks to be on with you today, Nate. I appreciate it. Good to hear your voice, and congratulations on the continued success of the show and the podcast.
Well, I've got to say congratulations to you, because I went back and looked. Last time I had you on the podcast, which was in the back half of 2019, Amplify had about $500 million in assets. You're now at $4.5 billion. I mean, just a tremendous growth story. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, we've really developed a diverse product line at Amplify that has done quite well in terms of, I think, being timely for investors over the last year and a half, 2 years, as well as really having some kind of market-leading performance. So, you know, whether you look at something like our online retail ETF, iBuy, which really shined last year as online retail really was kind of forced upon consumers in terms of multi-year growth. You know, iBuy ended up being one of the top 15 performing ETFs last year, up over 120%. Or, you know, our blockchain ETF, Block, which is the largest and the first actively managed ETF in the space, and finished in the top 30 of all ETF performers last year. Or really our Black Swan ETF that, you know, really delivered in the COVID lows when, you know, the S&P was off over 30%. Black Swan strategy was off just 5%. So we have kind of a variety of products that have really, I think, kind of shown brightly in the last 2 years. And 2021, we're off to another, you know, great start with two of our ETFs in the top 10 of performers. CNBS, our cannabis ETF, third best coming into this week of all ETFs, excluding inverse and leveraged, and Block, number seven year to date coming into this week. So pretty exciting times, and I look forward to continuing to see some more growth here.
Well, I was visiting with ETF.com's Drew Voros earlier, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but iBuy, that's up for ETF of the Year in the annual ETF.com Awards. It's also up for Best Thematic ETF. And another data point I'll throw out to listeners, if I look over the past year, Amplify ETFs have had nearly $3 billion in net inflows just over that time frame. Christian, I guess the question I'll ask you, because you know as well as anyone, if not better, how difficult it is to be successful in the ETF space. It's just a brutal gladiator sport. what have been some of the keys to your success?
Well, yeah, it has been very difficult to compete in the space. And, you know, I started in the space in the early 2000s, and it's only become more difficult as there's been more hurdles, larger kind of global asset managers getting into the space, you know, competition, copycat products, et cetera. You know, I think it starts with having compelling product, Nate. You really need to have product in, I think, you know, unique market segment or delivering on a strategy that isn't me too. You know, you have to stay away from that because it's just overpopulated in certain areas in the ETF space. And, you know, for a new sponsor, you don't want to have the, you know, the 19th version of what's already out there. And, you know, if you do something compelling, you really have to make sure you build awareness on it and kind of explain that differentiation. You know, unfortunately, there is a lot of firms that are larger now that have taken the approach of copying kind of first mover products. Oftentimes those copies aren't quite as good, maybe in terms of purity or uniqueness. They're really just trying to get the headline, if you will. And I think, you know, if you can build something that's compelling and then also increase the awareness of it and the differentiation, then, you know, hopefully time's on your side. And, you know, in the ETF space, there's groups that, you know, certainly try to time the market, and sometimes that works. You know, we've found, sort of like investing, that, you know, time in the market is on your side when you do have compelling product and something that's differentiated. And, you know, we've shown it. You know, our Block ETF, which was, you know, quite timely when it launched in 2018, had a lull really in 2019 and some of 2020, and ended up, you know, really coming into its own here in 2021, over $1 billion of AUM. We've had our cannabis ETF. That, you know, when it launched, wasn't the most timely product launch in terms of where cannabis was at the time. Now, you know, delivered, you know, second best performance last year in the space, and second best performance this year in the space, very consistent. So, you know, it's definitely an industry that's interesting because you can operate on a national, if not global, stage with an ETF and compete against, you know, multi-billion dollar, if not hundreds of or trillions of AUM asset management firms, and still be an entrepreneur. And, you know, at Amplify, we're not a large group. We have a experienced group of professionals, but, you know, we're going to be 5 years old here in April. And to your point, you know, we're producing some inflows and some product differentiation that I think competes with some of the largest sponsors in the marketplace. And we're going to continue to try to do that here. It's tough, but it's fun. And, you know, it's kind of rewarding when you have these times where a lot of things come together and you're able to see a surge in assets under management and ultimately some investor benefits in terms of outperformance or alpha or even defensiveness during trying times.
Christian, you mentioned cannabis and blockchain, which listeners of the podcast know these are two areas that I can't stop talking about. And so with our remaining time, I thought we might dig into each of these categories just a bit. And, you know, look, you mentioned performance. Both of these categories, you have ETFs that have been some of the hottest ETFs in the market in 2021. Let's start with cannabis and the Amplify See More Cannabis ETF, ticker symbol CNBS. That's up over 80% so far this year. What has been driving this space so far?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, you know, COVID really started to help out cannabis. It was in a bit of a lull. There's some valuations that got ahead of the space. But when COVID came around, there was not only a reset of valuations happening, but also for the first time, cannabis businesses started to be named essential businesses, kind of in a variety of different countries, and kind of hit up more of a mainstream acceptance from that standpoint. But also, you know, seeing kind of the political environment start to change, whether that's the acceptance or the of tax revenue from cannabis, that states and also nation states from a government standpoint are looking at, or, you know, the efficacy of using cannabis, whether that's, you know, via CBD or using cannabinoid products or compounds in different types of treatments. So, you know, very big change in kind of the perception of cannabis, and certainly kind of topping it off was the Biden administration coming in and being viewed as a lot more friendly towards cannabis, and certainly some of the legislation that seems to be moving at a little bit faster pace now that there has been election results completed here in the U.S. So that's really propelled cannabis to do quite well. And, you know, cannabis is a unique space in the sense that developments, whether it's legislative or even, you know, from a voting perspective, are occurring, you know, kind of constantly around the world. And that moves cannabis stocks quite a bit. We're even seeing some M&A. And we really believed, you know, to be in that space, you had to be active. You couldn't have a static portfolio that was rules-based, that, you know, only looked at the universe once a month, or once a quarter, or even twice a year. Instead, you needed a true expert managing that portfolio on a day-to-day basis. And for us, that was Tim Seymour, and he's really made all the difference in our cannabis ETF in terms of being able to buy and sell, to really be active in the space and create alpha. You know, last year, he was the second best performer with CNBS in the space, just behind another ETF that owned multi-state operators via swaps, which is something that we can't own at this point. This year, in 2021, he's the second best performer again, but it's a completely new ETF that's number one. The ETF that's number one this year was down 30% last year. So his consistency at being one of the top-tier performers, I think, stands out. And I think it's due to his kind of expertise in the space, his activity, his concentration in the portfolio. And, you know, we expect it to be continued good year for cannabis with some of the legislation that should be enacted here, I think, this year in the U.S., which opens up a lot more opportunities for kind of consumer products and banking and many of the other kind of capital market related functions as it concerns cannabis. So pretty exciting times for cannabis, and we're pretty pleased to be partnering with Tim to have CNBS out in the marketplace.
Do you feel like active management and Tim Seymour is the biggest differentiator here? Because I look at the cannabis ETF landscape right now. I believe there are 9 ETPs overall, but clearly with the performance and everything occurring in this segment of the market, I think you have a lot of investors really looking to this space now. I mean, what are some of the most important considerations that as investors evaluate their options here?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely, we think active is important because the landscape changes really weekly, and you need to be responsive in your portfolio. Tim is the differentiator for us, whether that's buying or selling based off M&A activity. We've certainly seen a lot of developments already in the space in the last 6 months. You know, the kind of the latest news out of Washington, D.C., in terms of some of the banking and other, you know, legalization trends that are going on, that's important. You know, we've been able to participate in several IPOs via CNBS this year. That's helped into 2020. That has helped the performance. So I think you need an expert. You know, one consideration is, you know, do you need exposure to U.S. companies, multi-state operators? You know, currently the only way to do that via a 40 Act fund or an ETF is to own swaps on securities that are operating here in the U.S., multi-state operators. CNBS currently doesn't have the ability to do that. There's a couple funds that do. We anticipate CNBS will actually have the ability to do that here in the near future. That's something investors have to, weigh whether or not they want exposure to those multi-state operators currently and taking on that derivative risk. We think that, taking on some of that risk probably is important based on what's happening in the U.S., but, as of right now, we have not. That probably is going to change here in the near future.
Christian, just a couple minutes left. I do want to briefly touch on blockchain and the Amplify Transformational Data Sharing ETF, ticker symbol BLOK. That's up over 60% on the year. This ETF, as you mentioned, has also taken in, quite a bit of money, over $500 million year to date. What is the quick thumbnail sketch of everything going on in this space and how you're capturing it with the ETF?
Yeah, so this is another ETF that we're active in, right? So we have 11 ETFs. Three of them are active. We're active for a reason when we decide to do an active ETF, and blockchain in this kind of crypto-sensitive stock space is very important to be active in to really adapt to what's going on in the marketplace. We have another real stellar portfolio management team in Toroso Asset Management, Mike Venuto and Dan Weisskopf. They're doing a lot of research and even conversations with companies as it pertains to purity. Block is really about blockchain, the application and the promise of that technology. Now, most of us know just one application of blockchain, and that is cryptocurrency. And certainly we do have exposure to a lot of companies that have sensitivity to crypto. We even own GBTC in the Block ETF. In fact, kind of an interesting stat. Block has actually outperformed GBTC since it's been out in the marketplace over 3 years, which a lot of people didn't realize. Block has a 0.7 correlation to Bitcoin, so there is a lot of sensitivity around Block's portfolio to cryptocurrency. But kind of the long-term play isn't necessarily crypto. It's really the promise of blockchain. So you see a variety of companies in the portfolio, everything from crypto miners to semiconductor manufacturers that specifically make mining equipment related to blockchain, transactional companies that are affecting transactions or custody or securities transactions regarding crypto and blockchain. So this is a portfolio that I think has a lot of legs. Again, most people understand blockchain because of one application of the technology, crypto, but there's a lot more coming. Block is a 5-star rated fund and the largest in the space. We think it's proven out the kind of the value proposition of active management and exposure to the space. And, the last thing I would say is look at the top holdings in Block. Most of those holdings aren't, owned by many ETFs. It's very unique. And that top 10 really tells the story in a quick, concise way of why Block is quite different than the other crypto or blockchain sensitive products out in the marketplace. And, we think this is quite additive. It's outperformed the NASDAQ, outperformed the S&P, outperformed GBTC since it's launched. And we're excited about the future of blockchain.
On the note of holdings, will this ETF be able to own the Coinbase direct listing? Because I could see that as potentially a nice tailwind for the blockchain ETF space overall.
Yeah, that will be a security that would be eligible for inclusion, and I suspect that will end up making its way to the portfolio.
You mentioned the correlation of Block to the price of Bitcoin. Before I let you go, I have to ask you, are we going to get a Bitcoin ETF anytime soon? And if so, I guess I would ask, does that hurt Block in any way? Or do you see it as additive?
Yeah, so I believe we will see a Bitcoin ETF. I think there's a good chance we'll see one this year. I think there's just so many reasons why, the ETF wrapper makes a lot more sense than some of the existing wrappers out in the marketplace. We've seen some innovation in the ETF space outside the U.S., and we really need to see something in the U.S. Seems like the SEC, which is changing in terms of its personnel, is going to be a lot more favorable to that. We don't think that actually hurts Block at all. We kind of look at the analogy I would give is, there's the GLD or the gold, the physical gold ETF, and then there's the gold miners ETF. We really believe that Block is kind of like the gold miners ETF. These are companies that have some leverage exposure to crypto and to blockchain in general. Crypto is one application of blockchain, but it's not everything on blockchain. And we actually expect to see, we have the highest correlation of any ETF to to Bitcoin at 0.7, but we see the correlation continuing to rise, and ultimately may actually see a greater than one correlation to Bitcoin, not unlike gold miners' correlation to the price of gold. So we see that as only expanding the audience. There's many advisors and professional investors who probably aren't going to own crypto directly, but want to have access to blockchain as a technology that and also has some sensitivity to crypto. And we think Block will be, you know, a great solution, or continues to be a great solution for those types of investors. So we think it just kind of creates a wider tent as, there'll be likely some nice innovation in the space. And I bet you there'll be 5 or 6, Bitcoin ETFs out by this time next year. So be interesting space to watch.
Well, Christian, we're going to have to leave it there. I always enjoy having you on the podcast. Again, congratulations on all the success. I really believe it's truly impressive what you're building there. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Nate. Really appreciate it. Take care.
That was Christian Magoon, founder and CEO of Amplify ETFs. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by the always colorful Todd Rosenbluth with CFRA. We're going to cover a bunch of different ETF topics. And then Phil Toews, CEO of Toews Asset Management, will spotlight the indexes behind two Agility Shares ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.